Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you. I always like to start the Veterans Committee with a portrait. These are written by women combat veterans. And this one is from Captain Clarice Scott, U.S. Army. And she says, "All the freedoms that we enjoy, people take for granted. You go over there," and she's referring to Iraq, "and see people fighting for them and actually losing their lives for their freedoms. I look at people who don't vote. Why don't you vote? People want to vote and can't vote. Things that people take for granted, I take more seriously. You sometimes see the actions of the younger children and teenagers these days in the USA. And are they paying attention to what's going on? All the freedoms that they have just to make bad decisions and go get in trouble? You see on the news somebody's robbing this person, killing that person. What are you thinking about? You have people that are fighting a war, that are losing their lives for you, so you can go and do some silly stuff like this." Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Appreciate that. I would remind everybody that if you have a cell phone in here, put it on stun or turn it off or something along that line. This is the emergency preparedness. We have radio waves flying all over in here, and the system seems to go berserko here if your phone's on, let alone it interrupts us. So if you power them down, put them on stun, airplane mode, or whatever happens to work. Colleagues, we're going to do a slight change of the schedule. We're going to we're going to hear 2708A first, because Senator Olson was kind enough to move to the front of the class, so we'll do his bill first, and then I think HCR 24 will do second, because Senator Widener sat in the back of the class. So with that, we're going to open a public hearing on HB 2708A. Council, if you would, Representative, if you would.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2708A. Creates the Fallen Hero Roadside Memorial Signs to recognize members of the United States Armed Forces killed in action or from wounds received in action, beginning with Eric McKinley and Tyler Troyer. Directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to set and collect a fee for associated costs and to establish the corresponding protocols. This measure moved off of the House floor unanimously as well as House Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, and members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm a state representative out of the Albany area. And I'll just, you have a letter in front of you. I'm just going to quickly read that to you. This is a very simple bill that directs the Oregon Department of Transportation to place hero memorial signs on Highway 34 near Philomath and Albany. These two signs will recognize Army Specialist Eric S. McKinley and Lance Corporal Tyler Troyer for their service to our country as they gave the ultimate sacrifice. For your viewing, I have attached an example of what the signs will resemble. The funding for the signs will be routed through the Roadside Memorial Fund, which is the body created 2 years ago with House Bill 3039, if you recall, which is tied in for the police officers. Additionally, in order for other legislators to add constituents to their district who have also given the ultimate sacrifice, there's a possibility of an amendment. And I just kind of want to explain that a little bit to you, too. I know Representative Sherry Springer is interested in introducing an amendment through this committee into this bill that would recognize an Army soldier, Kevin Davis. And Kevin Davis had been working with, well, as a reserve for Lebanon Police Department. And be truthful with you, when the two fathers came to me to talk about their sons, I actually didn't even think about Kevin. And Kevin was, was killed in line of action early on during the conflict over there in the war. I also had the opportunity to teach a couple classes to Kevin at Lynn Benton Community College, too, which was criminal justice stuff. So it makes more sense to add him as well, because that would tie in then toward the Highway 34 area toward Lebanon. So you would capture all of Highway 34 from Florida to Lebanon.
I appreciate that. And Representative Springer has your back right behind you nodding. So.
I see. Okay. Well.
One of you two gentlemen.
Go ahead. My name is Michael Thorpe. Tyler Troyer was my son. And on his note with Kevin Davis, and this is kind of strange, I graduated with Kevin Davis in 1982 from West Albany High School. So when I heard that he had gotten killed, that was, my son was getting ready to deploy. So that was, that hit very close to home for me as a parent, knowing that your son is getting ready to deploy, and then somebody that you went to school with and knew, you know, lost his life. And so that that made it very, that was the closest strike I had until my doorbell rang. So, but I wanted to basically, I don't know if you got these. This is my motivation. This is where I came up with this idea. Shane Cabino is a 19-year-old Lance Corporal from Massachusetts. He was a good friend of my son. And October 6, 2005, he got blown up by an IED. And I had the privilege of meeting his family in person. And Tyler's other brother, Michael, and myself, we actually went to Franklin, Massachusetts. And this bridge is named in his honor. And he got to see this bridge. You know, it was under construction before he deployed. But, you know, it's about a $20 million bridge that permanently has his name on it. And so on both sides. So when I came riding in a vehicle and coming upon and seeing the sign, you know, it grabs you, because you know this is, you know, a 19-year-old kid who had his whole life in front of him, and he lost his life. But the state of Massachusetts, in a way, decided that his memory is going to go on forever. Anybody that travels, I don't have no idea how many people travel on this, but every one of them is going to, they're going to see that sign and the flags, and it's going to make them look and make them think. And that is one of the reasons why when I got home, I really started thinking about the state of Oregon has nothing like this. The only thing that's close is the signs along the highways for the fallen police officers, and I think that's a fantastic idea, especially you know, if the signs can be erected where, you know, where they served you know, our citizens, and some of them actually lost their lives along the very roads that where these signs are, and I think this is something that really should be done for those young, you know, these young kids who not only are serving their communities, they're serving this entire country. You know, while, you know, I get to sit here and do this testifying right now, there's people in harm's way. You know, they don't work a 9-to-5 job. They are protecting, you know, other people, a whole in other countries, and I really appreciate that, and I really would like to see what these people that don't come back. There's a lot of these young men and women that come back, and they have suffered horribly, but they do come back, and they're going to have the rest of their lives. But only they understand what I feel, because they lost some of their friends and had to send them home in body bags. And as parents, we don't want anybody to forget the sacrifices of this country, and youngsters that make that choice to go do this, because they don't have to. There's no draft. Nobody has to. These kids signed up full well knowing that their life could be put in danger. As soon as they sign that, they're willing to die for their country. And these young men did. They did exactly that. And the state of Oregon, at the very least, should allow these kinds of things to be done, and it's not going to cost the taxpayers anything. And you know, if I got to foot the bill for my own signs, I have no problem doing that, because long after I'm gone, I want people driving down Highway 34 and be able to look at Tyler Troyer's name on that sign and know that he gave his life for this country forever, long after I'm gone. And there's going to be just generations and generations of people long after these wars are over, and I want them to see that. It's the only way you can see these names, other than going to a cemetery or someplace where there's a particular memorial with a name on it, because nobody knows where those are unless you go look for them. But of the millions of cars that travel on Highway 34 each year, I mean, their eyes are going to glance and see that name, and there's going to be new names every day. That go and look and think, and maybe, you know, there's not a lot of states that do this, But I'd like to think that maybe somebody from out of state that's driving through our great state will see such a sign, and they'll take this idea to their own state, because across this entire country, this is what should be happening. And it shouldn't take me to have to come forward to do it. And I'm surprised it never really was brought up by really anybody to be done. And you know, because you know, my son's been gone since 2005. That's quite a while, and some longer than that. And hopefully there won't be any more, but that's probably not going to be a reality. But I want to thank you for listening, and please consider passing this bill on. Thanks.
Thank you.
And when I walked in here, I noticed that my name is Dave Troyer, Tyler's dad. I noticed there are some veterans here, you know, from prior to my generation. And I want to take this opportunity to thank each one of them for their service, because without that, I don't think we would enjoy a lot of the freedoms that we have. And I'll be one of the first ones to say that until Tyler joined up into the military, I took the military for granted. Never thought that much about it. I knew they were there, but never really thought that much about it, what they did for us. But when Tyler joined up, you know, my thinking kind of changed a little bit, because I knew that there was that possibility that, you know, he may end up getting sent to Iraq or Afghanistan, knowing full well that if he did, what might happen. Then when we found out that he was going, my wife and I, you know, were like, well, okay, how do we prepare for what could happen, but yet hope that nothing does happen? You know, and it's kind of puts you in a position to where you hope for the best, pray for the best, but expect the worst. Because if you don't almost think of that, you know, it almost seemed like it would have a bigger impact. You know, and when Tyler did get killed, you know, it put a whole new perspective on what the meaning of Memorial Day is, what the meaning of veterans is, what the meanings of a lot of these holidays that we have pertaining to our veterans. Then when Michael, you know, come up with this idea and approached me on it, you know, I don't have a lot of that same, I don't want to say same thinking, you know, because we do need to honor our fallen, not only our fallen, the ones that are still living, you know. And to me, it just really opened my eyes, you know, because when I drive down I-5 and I see the fallen police officer signs, you know, there's just something there. They're there protecting us, you know, in our hometowns, you know, on the highways. For those people who aren't paying attention, don't care, whatever, I have a lot of respect for our police officers. And I never used to, but I used to be a lot younger too, and there again, take a lot of things for granted. But, you know, it's come, for me, it's got to the point to where anymore, if I see a police officer and I see him in uniform, I now thank him for what they do. When I see veterans that are wearing Vietnam hats, World War II hats, whatever the case might be, I try to go out of my way, if the opportunity presents itself, to shake their hand and thank them for their service, because it does have a meaning that a lot of people take for granted. And I, too, want to thank you for listening. And it's, you know, for this bill to go through the House of Representatives like it did, you know, we was there the day they did the vote, and it... My hair stood up on my arms, because there was all those people that, hey, you know what, they appreciated the sacrifice too. And I don't think there's very many people that don't appreciate it, but, you know, I, you know, request that you do vote for the passage of this bill, because it does mean a lot to those of us who have lost a family member. Thank you.
Thank you. Vice Chair.
Some of the best ideas come from people like you, and I'm so glad that you brought this forward, so thank you so very much, and I'm so very sorry for your loss. To thank them for their service too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sarah Olson.
Yeah. I'd like to make a motion that we suspend the rules and move the bill to work session.
I don't know, can we do that?
I don't think we can. It's not posted. I don't believe it's posted, but we're still waiting for an amendment for Senator Springer, or Representative Springer. So, and if I'll get Representative Olson just to step back and let Representative Springer come up. And go ahead and say that, gentlemen. And Representative Springer can come up here and
I Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sherry Springer, State Representative for House District 17, and I have had this electronically submitted to the committee administrator. It's an amendment, and frankly, I'll tell you, read the whole amendment to you since it's so incredibly brief. It just adds that Kevin Dwayne Davis on Oregon Route 34 near mile post 15, this simply adds another sign with Kevin's name on it, and certainly this is at the request of his mother. If you have any question, I'll certainly answer them to you. I understand that this bill has a very narrow relating to clause, and fortunately, this request was made on Highway 34, which fits neatly within that.
Good, thank you. And for the record, I think we're actually looking for another platform someplace, and the reason being is that it does have a narrow relating clause relating to Highway 34, and so we are working on that issue for other individuals to fulfill basically your request, which is we should have done this before, and it should be on other highways. As it turns out, rarely does it happen that there's so narrow a relating clause from legislative council. Your Representative Springer, Representative Olson will tell you that. Generally, it's so broad that, you know, and in this case, it's just much more narrow. And we do appreciate you bringing the bill forward. It's my plan right now because we have to get all the paperwork put together, and we are searching for another relating clause to be able to put this program into another bill so that parents like yourself and other individuals can come forward to do this on other highways. And at this point, we're all scheduled for a work session next week. I don't anticipate any problems, and then we'll move it out. And I do, like Madam Vice Chair, you know, I served in the sandbox, okay? And I had to call some people, like the people who called you, unfortunately. So I have a problem with this portion, but I mean, I understand the sacrifice that you've done, and you know, and I understand the reaction when, because I've been the person calling on the other end of the phone from the sandbox to do that. So I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else signed up? And colleagues, you know, when we get the paperwork together, it'll be scheduled for a work session, and we'll move it next week. Is that amenable to you?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Move it tomorrow if we could. Mr. President, can we move this tomorrow?
With that, I'm going to go ahead and, because is there anyone else that wants to testify on 2708? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2708. We're going to jump down to HCR 24. Madam Counsel, if you would, Representative Widener, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 24 supports veterans treatment courts concentrating nonviolent criminal cases involving veteran defendants on the same docket before the same judicial official for case management by multidisciplinary teams and volunteer veterans. This measure also moved out of the House committee and off the House floor with unanimous votes.
Representative, if you would, please. And I see Robert is on the list and another gentleman.
That was short-lived where I got to wear the senator status sitting back there, so.
We're always hopeful of your future.
So, Senator Boquist, members of the Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, and it's an honor for me to bring this bill before you today. As you can see, so many of you have signed on to this important resolution. And to watch the House Committee on Veterans pass this bill out of committee unanimously and to watch hit the House floor and pass the House floor unanimously, I thank everyone for their support. I know all of us here seek to fulfill the following words expressed by President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. As we express our gratitude, we must never forget that the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by those words. I think that by passing this resolution, we are taking action to help demonstrate to Oregon counties the importance of establishing a veterans court docket. This is another way we can appreciate our veterans and their service. It may seem like this bill is uttering more words, but if you're fortunate enough to have the chance to spend an afternoon in the Honorable Judge Vance Day's Veterans Court docket, like my staff had the opportunity to do in this past January, you too would also see that these courts change lives and help veterans restore their own self-confidence. The Veterans Court docket gives them the environment to reinstill their military values and reconnect with other veterans who have gone before them. The idea of no man left behind is exemplified in the court. As veterans who face similar issues after their own service, such as substance abuse, depression and anxiety, anger issues, domestic violence, return to mentor and fight the internal battle alongside these younger veterans needing help. Each veteran in the docket is paired with a mentor veteran who's overcome their problematic behavior and will work alongside them to lend their understanding ear and supportive hand and offer wise counsel to the younger veteran. The supportive and amazing community of volunteers involved in the docket includes substance abuse counselors, mentor veterans, the Sheriff's Office, Parole and Probation Board, Veterans Treatment Docket, coordinators of Veterans Justice Outreach members, officials from the District Attorney's Office, and the public defenders. All volunteer help to create the environment where these young veterans take personal responsibility and overcome their personal obstacles. Again, I want to thank all of you who have signed on and supported HCR 24, and a special thank you to the Honorable Judge Vance Day for his continued time and attention and unwavering support for this cause. And I would also like to thank the two gentlemen beside me, Mr. Thornhill and Commander Ellsworth, for their military service and participation in the VFW and for their civic participation and continued support of HCR 24. With that, I'm open to any questions.
Thank you. I think we'll hear from Mr. Thornhill, and we have all 13 pages of your testimony. I should tell you, 13 is my lucky number, and I always look forward to Friday the 13th. So you're doing good so far.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is Robert Thornhill. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I'm testifying in support of HCR 24 on behalf of Oregon VFW District 3 and its 5 VFW post. I've submitted written testimony, but with your permission, I'd like to read a summary of aspects of that testimony. Before I do that, I'd like to introduce my sponsor, so to speak, Post Commander Marion Ellsworth. Post Commander Ellsworth is an old 10-can sailor of the 4-Stacker Fleet, Asiatic Fleet, the first line of defense, and the last line of defense as the Japanese swept southward in the early stages of WW2. As far as I know, only one destroyer was shot out from under him. So, my buddy. Those who have answered our nation's call to arms deserve help in their struggles with this physical and psychological trauma of their service. Veterans courts are an effective way of providing help. I'll not elaborate on the proven effectiveness of veterans courts. Their effectiveness is widely known and described in HCR 24 itself. However, not covered in HCR 24, in addition to helping veterans themselves, veterans courts have other beneficial impacts. I want to address a couple of those benefits here. First is the impact on the veteran's family, whether a veteran has one. I suspect you have heard the truism, those who wait also serve. It is no less true for the family who waits while the veteran serves time in prison. Except in the first instance, the family, along with the service member, served with pride. Whereas in the case of serving time in prison, it is likely the family waits with shame as their veteran served prison time, also with the shame while bearing the stigma of being a convict. Such possibly could have been avoided with the intervention of a veterans court. Thus, it is suggested society owes the benefits of veterans courts not only to the veteran, but to the family, too. Second is the fiscal impact. Veterans courts are an investment. The VA estimates there are $3.36 saving for each $1 invested in veterans courts. Even without these savings, in our view, the troubled veteran is worth the investment. The savings could be even greater here in Oregon, though. The Department of Correction reports that it costs $85 a day, or $31,025 per annum to incarcerate an individual in an Oregon state prison. Thus, every veteran's salvage, so to speak, as opposed to being imprisoned, is a cost avoidance of over $31,000 a year. These savings, obviously, can be more productively spent on more urgent needs, such as K-12 education of our children, our future. Request the committee approve HCR 24. And thank you for hearing me out. And on behalf of the veterans of VFW District 3, I've been ordered to thank you for what you do here in Salem.
I'm glad somebody can order somebody around this building. Madam Vice Chair?
Yes. When I was campaigning to be reelected last summer, I came upon a young veteran who had come back from Iraq, and he was saying, "I'm wanted. I am wanted by the police, and I'm afraid." He had. I don't know what crime, but he had had a crime and then fled to California, but then came back after thinking about it, thinking, you know, I really need to show. This is the type of thing that would have benefited this particular person. I actually got him hooked up with a VSO who then helped him get somewhere to help him. But this is, I think, is extremely important. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Again, as long as we make it known that this is available to the veterans, it can certainly be helped. But I want to make a point that we do not believe and do not advocate that veterans not be held accountable for their actions. But we need to help them at the same time if we may.
If I may, Mr. Chair, to follow up. So what goes on in the Veterans Court is usually they'll have one judge who handles this and knows what's going on. They have soldiers who've been through it before that have struggled with these issues that come in. Because a lot of times I have a son who was in the service who just got out, and he suffered from PTSD when he was over there. We just had a case of a young man actually in my district, one of my constituents, that just snapped because all of a sudden they forget where they're at, and something triggers something from the war that makes them go off the deep end. So when you need people who understand these issues, and the Veterans Court's designed to have those kind of people in place to help understand what's going on with them at that time, and then you run a lot of veterans through on a single day at the court system. So that way they have people that have worked with them, understand the issues, and are there to support them and get them back on their feet and try to keep them from ending up in the prison system and give them the help that they need.
Sarah Olson?
This is another one of these bills, but I'd like to make a motion that we move it today. Sir, thank you very much for this. This is important to veterans. I was looking through the packet that you put out, and I noticed your recommendations to the governor's task force dated June 2008 for tuition waiver programs. I just want to make it clear for the record that I have a bill that will allow any veteran honorably discharged to get in-state tuition in our state. So we're on the same page. This is a good bill, and it'd be a pleasure if I could carry it to the floor.
Thank you very much, sir.
Senator Olson, I'm probably going to give you multiple opportunities next week to carry bills on the floor. I appreciate you bringing this forward. We'll allow the public to bring testimony over the next week. We'll schedule for a work session next week, as we will the previous bill, as Senator Olson mentioned over there. And so we'll bring it forward next week. And just for the record, generally, in this committee and Mr. Thornhill and the commander know, we schedule a hearing 1 week and then we schedule the work session the next week, because so many veterans don't hear about the bill until it comes up and it's in the newspaper the next day that it was in, had a hearing, and then they want to have their say too. The one thing you can assure veterans will definitely want to have their say. And so they'll want to have their input. And so we'd invite anybody on any of the bills today, including this one, to send in testimony that we can put into the record, and it'll be placed into the record for next week. But again, we'll put it on the docket for a work session next week. We appreciate the three of you testifying, and we'll move on down the list. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing at HCR 24, step one step back and go back to HCR 23 and open a public hearing. And
Rep Springer, I don't think is here. There she is. Okay, she wants to move up, and you can bring anybody with you you want because you have two more seats.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 23 honors United States military service members exposed to unsafe levels of radiation from nuclear weapons testing between 1945 and 1962. This measure also moved out of the House committee and off the House floor with unanimous votes.
Ladies first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, once again. For the record, Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. And I proudly bring you HCR 23 today that moved off of the House floor. And let me give you a little bit of background where this bill came from and why I'm here with this bill. And then there's some great experts here that have something I think more valuable to share than I myself. So it's been a good 2 years now that my friend here, Fred, called me up and said, would you come speak at our Atomic War Veterans Annual Meeting in Lebanon? And I said what I usually say, sure, what's the date and time, and I'll be there. And I hung up the phone, and I'm embarrassed to admit, I said, what in the world is an atomic war vet? And I thought I had a fairly decent working knowledge, so I started doing some research. And I learned a lot, and I was surprised by what I learned. And maybe I did know a little something about that era, affectionately referred to as the Cold War. And so I'm going to back up and tell you a little bit more about that, but an interesting thing occurred, and this is exactly why I have this bill before you, this resolution before you. So I showed up at that meeting and shared some words. That's always an intimidating group to go before a group of veterans that have committed and sacrificed and served a lot, and then you go and supposedly have some words to share. And I found the best thing that I can do in that opportunity is say thank you. So I had my son there at the time, probably 13, and he was listening, and he walked out, and frankly, I drug him there because I had other appointments. We got in the car, and he said, what was that about? And I start talking to him about him. He goes, well, what was the Cold War? Really, what was that? So I started talking about what the Cold War was. Well, he started chatting with his friends about it, and certainly a middle schooler at that time didn't have a single friend that knew anything about this. And it was his freshman year in high school. He needed to do a report on in one of his classes. And he chose this topic to do the report on. That's why this conversation is important today, because that 13-year-old that wasn't even a thought during the Cold War, whose parents were kids during the Cold War and didn't know anything other than maybe some fear, has now taken that to a school and talked about it in a very real way. So as all of you I know are aware, the Atomic War Vets are this group of people that served between 1945 and 1962. And what is so interesting about this group is most of them, well, at the time they didn't know, and certainly even now many of them don't know that they are atomic war vets. And I know that's something Fred's going to talk about a great deal here, because this is his passion. This is a driving force for him. But I want to read you something very briefly and then turn it over to him. It was a time where the United States feared that tensions with the Soviet Union and its satellite states could potentially result in a nuclear war. The United States performed nuclear arms tests to ensure that if such a war did occur, they would have effective weapons. Because of these tests, the main health risk linked to the Cold War is nuclear exposure due to nuclear weapon testing. Veterans from this conflict are often referred to as atomic vets because of their exposure to the atomic weapons. There were over 200,000 U.S. service personnel exposed. Today, there are still some that don't know that they were exposed. And it wasn't until 1996 that they were allowed to speak of this, if they knew what they had been guarding. Sometimes it was as simple as that building over there, guard it. Well, in that building were nuclear weapons. And it wasn't until 96 that they were released to talk about this. And the thing that probably disturbs me the most about this issue, as I've spent a couple years on this now, is my father was a World War II vet, and that status is very important to people. and their country and their dedication to their country is very important. Yet if they were threatened with treason, if they shared their experience, I mean, that's the ultimate cost for a veteran. That truly is. And what a terrible position to be in and be told you can't even talk to your wife about this. That just grieves me when I think about that. So this is a resolution. It would consist of words. I fully admit that. But it is yet another opportunity that we need to seize to talk about this, yet another opportunity we need to seize to let our kids know about this. And will this be published in local newspapers, high school newspapers? I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it. But it will once again hit the press. And one of the underlying reasons, frankly, very practical reason, is yet maybe another atomic war veteran has the opportunity to say, you know, I was there during that time. I wonder if. And then connect with my good friend Fred. Because there's resources available, because of the health health concerns and the detrimental effects that this exposure caused. So with that, I'm going to finish up. Certainly, when we're all done, I'll answer any questions that you may have about the bill. But these are the experts here. And I think they've got a couple stories that they want to share with you.
My name is Fred Schaefer. And at 19 years old, we were cleared for security purposes for top secret, which we didn't know anything about until after we were on our way. And then we were notified all cameras would be confiscated, and we'd be going across the equator, but we were down for nuclear testing, which we didn't know what was going on. Been going on for several years. And this 62, when I was at Christmas Island, it was supposed to be the last above ground test, that series of tests. And I think there was a total of 21 tests. And we got down and we got to see these bombs go off. And 11 o'clock during the day, and we were lucky in that time era, we had dark glasses that we put on. You put them on. A lot of the guys prior to test didn't have nothing to wear. And at 11 o'clock, you put them on and you can see absolutely nothing. And when that bomb went off, it's broad daylight. And the guy in front of you, you got to see his rib cage through his body. It was just a giant x-ray. They said, put your hands over your face or up over your eyes. And you saw your bones and your fingers, not flesh. And it's sort of shocking, but one of the things that I could remember when I left the island, as our ship steamed away, I said, they've got to have a clean bomb. This government would not do that to me. And then I found out that, yes, my government would do it to me, and a lot of other troops prior to. But it's now where a lot of the guys are dying off. VA has come on board. When I first got out, and I started talking about this. I've got all kinds of stories of people that came to me and told me stories about how they were affected by things that they did and said, and what they were threatened with was treason. You're going to go to the federal penitentiary if you talk about it. And VA couldn't talk to me about it until 96, and then it was a brand new door opened up. They started being able to talk to us. So we're getting some of the benefits that are going through. A lot of the guys that passed away before us were tickled to death to see where we are today if they were around. But they started the ball rolling back in about 1976. And I took it here in the state of Oregon. It was my baby, and I wanted to make it work. And so far we've got, that I know of now, we've got a little over 130, 140 atomic veterans, but we're losing them daily. So that's what I'm after. It's just that we get the recognition.
Hi, my name is Frank Farmer. I was in the service in 1958. I was in Aniwetok in the South Pacific. We had, that year, they had 36 atomic tests. I was in 18 of them, standing on the top deck of the ship with a pair of jeans, a t-shirt, and nothing else on. He's lucky. I didn't get glasses. They told us to turn our back to where the blast would be, put our hands over our eyes, and you actually saw your bones with your eyes shut. And we didn't. I was just a country boy from Tennessee at the time, and I had no idea what I was looking at until later down the road. They would tell us you can go swim in the water, you can catch fish, but you can't eat them. Now all this radio fallout from the bombs come right back down into the water where our ships are dropped anchor. We made our drinking water out of that water. We showered out of that water. And we decontaminated our ships with that dirty water. So as the time went on, I realized how much I had to have a lot of exposure to this radiation. One bomb was 156 kiloton. When that went off, the first one I saw, that was it. When it went off, I had tinnitus ringing in my ears. I still have it today. It never went away. The VA finally, in 2004, after I met Fred, I was able to go to the VA, and I didn't know I could even do that till then. And I got hearing aids, and that has helped some. But I still have the problem with that. And I have a rash that I got out there. I got scratched on the coral. And within a week, my lower extremities of my body was almost a solid scab. They say that it was jungle rot. Well, now the VA says it's
iodized radiation.
No. What is that they say that I got in?
Psoriasis.
They call it psoriasis now. I think my opinion is they're using psoriasis as a catch-all like they did jungle rot back in those days. But in any case, I feel lucky to be where I am at 77 years old. And I just want, we want to get something done to where the people will know what has happened and that this won't be forgotten. It needs to be remembered, I think. And it's just, it's been a thorn in our side for a long time, but we're feeling better about it. And anyway, I want to thank Sherry Springer. She's been a wonderful advocate for us. And I would like to thank you guys for listening to us and see what we can be have done. Thank you.
John?
I'm John Gabrielson. I'm a Korean veteran. I worked out of the 505th Military Police Battalion, and I did investigations and witnessed numerous bombs being blown up out in Yucca Flats and in that area. And in the 1950s, I was in the teapot explosion there, and suffered some radiation burns and so on and so forth. Afterwards, or during this period of time, I did investigations in throughout Las Vegas and that area, and we had to everybody signed agreements to not talk about this for 50 years. And I did myself, and I hadn't spoken, period, not once during that period. Because who the hell is going to listen to me? Nobody. But yet, there's a number of my friends that were there that are now dead, and the federal investigation over in St. George, Utah, where the wind blew, the only time they would blast would when the wind would blow that direction towards St. George, Utah. Suddenly the sheep started to die, people started suffering different maladies and so on and so forth. I couldn't talk about it. If I got someone who did speak about it, and I had the facts, they were probably sent to the front lines in Korea. And for all these years, I've got some PTSD problems myself. I'm going to be 80 years old, and spent 50 years after that in law enforcement with a job with the California Highway Patrol, where I retired. Was appointed by President Ronald Reagan to do some work for the federal government, which I did. I served as coordinator with the state police, worked with Andy Olson. So these veterans, that many of them that I knew during this period, are now dead. I've got skin problems, other problems. I've never, you know, filed for any retirements or anything from the federal government. But it was my job to investigate the individuals who were witnessing this and sitting and opening their mouths in bars or something like that. And I look back now and said, what was I doing, you know, at that time? I was fairly young, and but I've always been very active in enforcement and support the all law enforcement agencies very strongly. But through my investigations, people died in the front lines in Korea, and I suffer from problems with that when they're not allowed to even speak of it for 50 years. Thank you all very much for listening.
And we,
if I might, add, I was told like they were to, I couldn't talk about it to my mother, my sister, my wife. If I did, I'd be tried for treason. We went to Pearl Harbor from San Diego, and my wife, which was my girlfriend at the time, sent me a piece out of the paper, San Diego Union Tribune. It told where we were going, how many ships was in the, going to be involved in the test, and where we were going to wind up at Aniwetok. I gave it to my commanding officer, and I said, I thought we weren't allowed to talk about this to anything or anybody. And he said, that's true. I said, well, read this piece out of the paper. He read, and he said, can I borrow this? I said, yeah. So I was his duty driver at that time. I drove him up on the hill in Pearl Harbor to the admiral, and he showed it to the admiral, and the admiral would not give it back to him. He said, this can't be. It should not have been. He was going to investigate it. Whether he did or not, I don't know. But I was told not even to tell my doctor where I had been and what I had been through. And when you can't even tell the VA doctor what your problems are, then there's something wrong with that. It's just, thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your service. Madam Vice Chair?
Just thank you for bringing this forward and making us aware. I was not aware of the extent of the exposure to our men. I knew what happened over there in Japan, but, you know, that's all you hear about and all the effects there. But happening to our own servicemen, it's an eye-opener. Thank you.
If I might add something else. They say that this, all of this was to test equipment, men, and the guns and stuff to see what would happen with an atomic blast. But you know, that was in 1958. They have never contacted me to see what's happened to me down the road. So that kind of sets a fire under you too, you know. So there's a lot of things that just don't add up.
Sir, for any questions? Senator Olson, and yeah, I know the amendment thing, okay, so spare me on that one. Yeah, anything else? Gentleman Representative Springer, I mean, I appreciate you bringing this forward. We'll schedule it for a work session next week. I would like to tell you that on November 4th, 1962, which is the date Representative Springer determined to put in this resolution, that after that date that there weren't any events, either nuclear or chemical or others similar to you. But I did 34 years in the military, and I'd be an absolute liar if I told you that. I would just tell you that, you know, I'm familiar with
just as, unfortunately, just as egregious as events that aren't old, that aren't ancient. And I think there's probably a federal court judge in Portland that would tell you this week who just adjudicated one of those events involving 8 veterans in the state of Oregon that happened within the last decade. And so next time you, I guess the one thing I would leave you with is the one thing I like to tell some of my colleagues, and that is that just keep in mind that all those generals and admirals are all political appointees. And so we have the same problems we have today, unfortunately, than we had back then. I know that's not any condolence, but keep that in mind when you read the newspaper or see the 6 o'clock news and you see the commander of the Pacific Fleet and some of his statements even made in the last couple of weeks. Again, we'll schedule this for a work session next week. We encourage any other atomic veterans that are out there that would like to have something entered into the record, because maybe someday middle schoolers or high schoolers will go back and look at that record as a class project, and they'll see not only what you had to say, but what other individuals had to say and other individuals that put it into the record. With that, again, I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate your service. And I'm unfortunately appreciate the ultimate sacrifice some of your friends paid, not because of a bullet from the enemy, but because of an experiment of their government. So I don't believe there's anybody else scheduled. Anybody else want to testify on this? If not, with that, I appreciate it again, and we'll close the public hearing on HCR 23.
Thank you.
And we're going to move to HJM 9 and open a public hearing. And Mike, you can't write very well. Your picture looks so young in that thing, so please make your way up here. Council, will you bring us up to speed on HJM 9?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, HJM 9 urges Congress to change the funding of veterans' health care from discretionary to permanent and direct entitlement.
And Mr. Sullivan, I do want to ask you this. I asked Larry Campbell my third term here, because he used to have this book in the lobby, right? And obviously the picture was taken when he was like the speaker or the president of something, because it was at least 35 years old. And one of your fellow union members brought me an article with your picture in it, and an article on a bill that's not this one, but before the chambers right now. And you look all of 39 years old in that picture. So I don't even know what your secret is, but maybe you could share it with our committee how you're looking so young.
For the record, Chair Boquist and committee members, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. And that photo, I'm thinking, was taken in 04, because in 05 I had chlamydia pneumonia, which I was in intensive care for 18 days, life support for 8. So I don't know what I look like now, but I wouldn't have been around if I hadn't had really good health care and a wife who was an RN. I'm here today to talk about House Joint Memorial 9, and if Chair Boquist would allow me, I'd like to give some history of how long this has gone on. But before I begin, I want to mention that Representative Esquivel gave up a priority bill to make sure this was possible this session. When I started doing this job for AWPPW in 2005, I found out that there hadn't been a Veterans Committee for almost 50 years. This session, I went to the Legislative Library, and I might add it's staffed by the Oregon State Library. I asked the staffer named Rob to check out actually what it was. He and fellow staffer Dave found out that it was actually 1963. So knowing, Vietnam and all that went on, there hadn't been a Veterans Committee until 2005. The chair of the committee then was Donna Nelson. And as Chair Boquist will remember very well, she was pushing through 156 bills on veterans. That's how backlogged it was. It was Chair Boquist and Representative Dave Hunt who had to ferret through all that and to pare it down. At that time, the representative would start the meeting by asking all the veterans to stand up, and she'd have the committee stand, and then they would applaud. Steve Lanning, who was working for the AFL-CIO then and served during the Vietnam War, like myself, remarked to me later it was the first time anybody ever thanked him. and I concurred. In 2003, I read an article from the Disabled American Veterans, and it was about the funding of health care. The article went on to explain the budget was discretionary, meaning the VA had to ask for a budget annually. I took the article to Chair Nelson, and she made a bill out of it. It became House Joint Memorial 18, which is much like the present bill before you today. You know, if it was funded, mandatory, then the VA would have a better idea of how they could staff for nurses and doctors and other important things for the VA. So it's really important. In 2011, in the 2011 session, House Joint Memorial 18 successfully passed through the House, and it was in this committee. I gave testimony, and Vice Chair Mons Anderson asked me, had I ever heard anything from the federal government? The answer then, as now, is no. And so I wrote a letter to the Mr. Adams, National Service Legislative Officer for the Disabled American Veterans, and I wrote him what I call the Mons Anderson question. He, like the federal government, never answered me back. So we ask the young in our country to go fight wars. They take up their arms and they support the needs of this country. As the DVA says, all gave some gave all, and I would add, all gave some of the best years of their lives for this country. I think it's only fair and proper that the best health care for those who stood up for this country when it was needed should be. In closing, considering the lack of the federal government's response at all, and assuming that House Joint Memorial goes through this chamber as it did the House 5802, I'm asking you, Chair Boquist, to sign on with your counterpart in the House for a letter to accompany this Joint Memorial 9 to the Secretary of State, along with the Secretary of State, who I've made a meeting with, to ask the Congress to do the right thing. Perhaps the additional chairs and the Secretary of State might get the Mons Anderson question answered. And I thank you, and I'll answer any questions that may come up.
I appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I find it interesting because, as you said, 1963, and it's Senator Courtney and then Representative Minnis who started forming veterans committees and bringing veterans to the forefront. And I, of course, remember some of those meetings with a good representative and then Dave Hunt and I trying to negotiate to get things to try and move things forward. It is a strong compliment that both you, Bill Clutine, and the labor unions have been the strongest supporters of veterans since 2005 forward. There isn't a veterans bill that comes up that one of the traditional labor unions doesn't come forward, yourself or Bill or others, and, you know, trying to push to help veterans. And I mean, it's quite a compliment and a community outreach to the unions. Madam Vice Chair, questions?
I want actual change. I get very disappointed. Sometimes I wish that all that money could be more directed to the states, appropriations to the states, and then let us take care of our veterans with their health care needs. But thank you for bringing this forward.
You bet. Thank you, Chair Boquist, for the compliment, and thank you, Senator Mons Anderson. Definitely Oregon leads this nation in trying to do the best for the veterans that they can, no doubt.
Thank you. Senator Courtney, questions? Short of an amendment, Senator Olson?
No amendments. Mike, this is a great bill. Should have been happening a long, 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 long time ago. It's amazing that we have to remind the folks of our nation the sacrifices that veterans make. And it's unfortunate even more so that we have to remind Congress to do their duty, because they're the ones that get us into these messes, and they don't want to pay for it to get us out of them. So, great bill. I'd like to move it today if we could.
I hear you. Thank you.
Senator Olson, between generals, admirals, and congressmen, I think we've hit the nail on the head here.
Yeah.
And just for the record, Senator Mona Sanderson and I do have our pens ready, so when it comes to that. Again, I appreciate bringing it forward. We'll schedule this for a work session next week. If there's any individuals that would like to provide additional testimony, or, you know, I'm happy to invite a member of Congress or an admiral or general to come forward and join us in supporting veterans for once. With that, I'm going to...
Just one more comment, Senator Bokus, Chair Bokus. It would be nice, I don't know if it would make any difference, but once this passes, it would be nice if a copy could be sent to each of our congressional members, because I don't want this just to go back there and be lost. I mean, I don't even know. We send this, but I don't know the process. We send it, and what is the process on how we get this to the attention of our congressional leaders?
To my knowledge, Madam Vice Chair, it's sent back. It's memorialized and distributed back there. I know fairly routinely, though, committees take a copy of it, draft a letter, as Mr. Sullivan pointed, and then send it to our own members of the congressional delegation to ensure that they pay attention to what's going on and what we're doing it. Now, of course, if we hadn't passed that amendment, we could jerk the chain of those two United States senators at the legislative level and say, hey, you need to get this done.
Mm-hmm.
But and I think that's pretty much the process. Mr. President, are you aware of how else the process works?
I'm not.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 9 and open a public hearing again. I'm looking here. This is a standalone, right? Open a public hearing on 2044 and I think simultaneously 2046. And, Council, if you'll just brief us very, very briefly of the report we're about to get back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you'll remember House Bill 2044 and 2046 improving the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs conservatorship program was on for hearing both of these bills last week, and there was some follow-up requested from the members, and so they have returned with some additional information and provided, I believe, a PowerPoint that they're going to show to address some of those issues from last week.
And colleagues, if you remember, we discussed previous problems long predating the two people going to make testimony here, and the issue of making sure we had on the record the future of this program, where it was going, and the economic impact it might have on our budget. And with that, Director, it's all yours.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and as the good committee administrator, Council said, the House Bill 2046 and House Bill 2044, there was a good comfort level, I think, from members of the committee, but definitely some good questions that we wanted to go through, and if there are any questions remaining after the presentation, we'll be happy to answer them. I'll hand off to Kelly.
And welcome again.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kelly Brashears, for the record, conservatorship manager with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and so we have put together a presentation for you guys today, and hopefully we ticked off all the boxes with all of your questions. So we're going to
melt down.
No, we're not going to melt down. This is nothing. All right, now we're ready. So we're going to start off asking, answering some of the client demographic questions that you had the last time we were here. So as you can see by the chart, about 81 veterans of the 151 that we have under conservatorship are Vietnam veterans, which is 53%, so about roughly half of our clients are Vietnam veterans right now. One of the other concerns that you guys had was the Gulf, Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom, which actually are included in the Gulf War veterans at this point. So of those four, three of those are OIF, OEF veterans, and then one is an actual Gulf War from the 90s veteran. I kind of wanted to clarify that because it was a little... And then, as you can see, the other roughly half of those are kind of spread between peacetime dependents. Not very many World War II and Korean War veterans left. I did a little slide here on our client living situations. That was a question that came up, and we had talked about it last time we were here. So I did kind of just from some informational stuff for you guys about people who are living independently versus people who live in some type of supervised living situation. There is an asterisk next to the adult foster care home. Although that is a supervised living facility, the supervision is very limited. The clients who live in those facilities are able to leave freely whenever they want. They can go to the store. They can go to the doctor on their own. So there is some supervision in those facilities, but not nearly as much as the residential care and nursing home. So I kind of wanted to put that caveat in there.
Are any of these in VA homes?
We currently, okay, don't quote me on this, but I believe we have two clients in the Oregon Veterans Home right now. And as far as Veterans Home go, we do have many clients on VA nursing home contracts where the VA picks up their nursing home, their cost of care, and they're in just regular community-based nursing homes.
I see.
That are contract facilities. So one of the other questions we talked about was sources of income. And I know that there were some concerns about potential growth and whether those new clients that would be coming on board would have the income to help sustain this program. So we put together this slide, and this is, the whole is all of the monthly income for our combined clients. So of that, 73% of the income that comes in for our clients comes from the VA, 23% from Social Security. The 3% from retirement could include state, private retirements, DOD, all of those. And then the other is obviously a very small percentage, could include rental income, things like that. Not on a slide, although I put it on my notes, 125 of our clients receive both VA and Social Security. So that 96% of the income that comes in, the majority of that comes from about 125 of our clients.
Chair Wilkins?
Yes.
Is the VA benefit a fixed benefit?
The VA benefit, some of it is. Some of that 73% is. That number includes both VA compensation, which is a fixed benefit. They get 70% or 100%. There's a set rate for that every month. The variable would only be in VA pension benefits. So DIC, which is dependents and indemnity compensation, it's paid to either the widow of a veteran or the surviving dependent child of a veteran. Those benefits also are static. So,
follow-up, please.
Yeah.
What would be their average income of a disabled veteran?
Service-connected disabled veteran? I would say our clients, the majority of them, I'm not sure we have any right now that are not 100%. So the average income is about $2,900 a month, $2,963, I think is the going rate right now.
Thank you.
So this slide is talking about our fee structure and our pro bono rates. Right now we are at a 15% pro bono rate, which is about average for industry, 15 to 20%. So this isn't anything unusual. I believe that the Vice Chair had some questions last time about what our highest and low rate was. The low obviously is a zero because we do have clients we waive fees on. The high is 442. Mm-hmm. And then we put in an average there of $177.19 per client.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just note that the 15% pro bono, after an individual passes away, then we do on, regardless of their benefits, we do not charge on an ongoing basis after they've passed away. So even of those 23 clients, you thought...
We are actually, so we have 151 open cases right now, meaning that both live and deceased. If you took out the deceased cases, we're actually at a 10% pro bono rate right now. So those deceased cases kind of throw that number up because once they pass away, we cut off our fees. It gets a little too confusing to try and figure out what the fee would be when it's a percentage of income. So,
Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yes.
On the actual high that you have there, what would be this? What would be their income that you charge them $442 a month?
You made me do some math here in my head. 442 is 5% of their total income.
That's all I need to know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you didn't want me to do that math. So we set up this slide here to talk about the average cost per year, just to kind of show you per client. And so what we did was we took the $177.19 from the previous slide and multiplied by 12-month period. So the smaller one there, the $21.26, is what our average fee would be per client in an average year. And then the other one shows, because we are right now about 70% lower than the private sector, that shows what the private sector would charge on average for that same for the same services. And so then this was, I think, one of the big questions that we had. So the top row there shows our 2009-2011 biennium actual figures. So we have our general fund, our conservatorship fees, and our loan, home loan, other fund coming in. The 2011-13 projected to go through. And then the 13-15, these numbers are the projected numbers without a fee increase, just as we stand right now. This one shows the 2013-15 budget with a projected fee structure of 7% at our current client base of 151. So as you can see, it brings down our home loan mm-hmm. other fund by $210, which I believe is where we came up with a 210 that was in our...
It was, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the $210,000 was called out in the fiscal estimation by
LFO.
LFO.
Yeah. So, and then this one is a projected with a 2015-17, strictly the 7% fee structure and bringing our client load up to 180, which is not an unfeasible number for us to carry on a caseload right now. And as you can see, it zeroes out our home loan.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, obviously the home loan program has been a heavy subsidy to the tune of $280,000, just under $300,000 to this program. That's in subsidy of direct costs. There would still be, even when we can zero it out with the fee structure, there would still be some shared costs across the agency that would be flowing to the home loan program. So not a complete wipeout of the subsidy, but would go significantly towards that goal of reducing that subsidy. 180 clients for the increase, that would be about a 20% increase. We think we could absorb that under current staffing levels. Eventually, you do kind of reach a tipping point where it's too many clients for the staff teams, the two teams that we have, a trust officer and a trust officer assistant under Kelly. At that point, it kind of becomes a tipping point. In addition to these models, just on the fee structure, with some of the vision that Kelly's brought to the program in terms of different business models that we can bring to it, we believe even with the projected increases in the numbers of clients, if we see more of the Vietnam generation, if we see more of the Iraq and Afghanistan generation, we believe with some business practices changes, we're even looking at plans of how can we reduce the impact on the general fund. We've kept it consistent with inflation on the general fund appropriations here on these slides. But with some of the planning that we're doing, we're hopeful that even as we begin to serve more clients, this can become even more of a self-sufficient program separate from the general fund. And I think in our discussions, it was important, as we do get clients, we will have some that aren't able to pay the fee structure, and we're flexible with that pro bono benefit. But many of these veterans, either due to the service-connected disability that they bring from their military service and the VA benefits or their Social Security income, many of them do come with income that a small slice at a very competitive rate can help pay for these critical services. So we're happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Please. Chair, yeah. I mean, I find it shocking that the private sector would charge $7,085 for the same services that you provide for $2,126. So do you see then with with this bill giving you the ability to, by rule, raise it, are you going to try to become more competitive or just to cover your costs?
I don't believe we have any intention at this point.
I wanted to get that on the record.
We don't have any intention at this point of making a profit out of this. I mean, we're a government agency. This is at this point, we're trying to cover our costs. We're trying to cover our costs enough to have enough staff members and do provide the services that need to be provided. We realize that that those needs are going to go up, and we certainly have every intention of doing what we can to cover those costs and try to be as self-sufficient as possible, but we have no intention of trying to overtake the private sector and
I don't think
start our own company.
Thank you.
Chair Boquist, Senator Monis Anderson. To be very honest, the generous general fund appropriation is what allows us to keep this structure at a very reasonable rate. And when we look to reducing that general fund appropriation, it's not by jacking up the fee structure long term where it's on even with the private sector, but really looking at different business models and lines that we're not in right now in terms of bill, rep payee, where you can serve you could serve probably 180 clients under rep payee with one staff member, be able to generate some fair revenue off of that that can backfeed into the ones that do cost more in terms of time and effort in terms of the larger conservatorship efforts.
Thank you.
Chair Oldham? Two questions. One is if you shared this with LFO.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have.
Okay, because that was one of the key points we wanted to do, to have on the record that LFO grasps the way forward 2, 4, 6, because, I mean, you're forecasting 4 years out right now, and we'd like to get in the habit of forecasting 6 years out here. And then I want to change topics just slightly that's related to this, but ask a question of you, because I now have a number to figure out how you do these Ouija boards. $29.63 average benefit per month times 12 months equals something, and I didn't bring my calculator, so I won't worry that. But a lot of us have pursued, Senator Monis Anderson's been involved in this in the past, Senator Courtney, the whole idea of if you get veteran service officers to get people on to federal veterans benefits, then we can, of course, decrease some dependency on OHA, DHS, so on and so forth like that. I'm curious, now seeing a real number for the first time, has thought been given, and probably hasn't because you're the new director, but has thought been given, and I don't know the procedure, and I'm sure it would take legislative action on our part, including through Senator Monis Anderson's committee, but has thought been given of having a veteran service officer or a designated veteran service officer or several of them work through the DHS and OHA type case files to identify veterans, schedule meetings with them, and try and determine how many of these we might be able to get off of DHS federal benefits and on to veterans federal benefits, which of course is not a matching money, which therefore generates more funds into our state programs. I know Director Willis and I had discussions that I've heard everything from HIPAA to 27 other federal laws that you violate,
right.
But we're about to come into a new era most likely, and I don't know what your thoughts that you and I've had discussions about how do we get more veterans on federal VA veterans benefits, because we have 300,000 not on them.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it has been the driving force, I think, of our claims and counseling of both with the county partnerships and with the national service orgs. How do we, roughly right now, we've got about a third of our veterans, of our 330,000, signed up for some kind of benefits, whether it's through the federal VA health care side of the house or the compensation and pension on the disability and claim side. We're looking at ways that we can drive that outreach and even some new monies potentially flowing through Ways and Means down to the county level to drive those numbers higher. We have seen some partnerships across Department of Human Services and ODVA at the state level, specifically looking at on the healthcare side where it may be a veteran who's and on the OHA side, where it is still federal benefits in terms of Medicaid, but comes with that state match. It hasn't always been a clear-cut win in terms of whether for the veteran and their family to switch always from the Medicaid side to the federal VA benefit. So we always want to make sure that it is in the best interest of the veteran and their family. It hasn't been a huge windfall in terms of that perspective. But we are looking at, as some of the committees wind down on their hearings on bills, looking at trying to have a joint hearing between the healthcare side and the veterans community. The healthcare worlds have been changing at such a fast pace, it's been hard sometimes to throw our wrench of the veterans issues. But I think the VA, the federal VA healthcare system, is one of the first truly integrated, coordinated care organizations across a large and diverse hospital system and clinic system across the U.S., some of the first to use electronic records, first to have the incentive to invest in preventative upfront care for their veterans, figuring out how we link the legislature's and the governor's vision on coordinated care organizations and the link to the federal health care benefits will be a huge win over the next 10, 20 years.
Good political tap dance. My question here is more specific, and that is we obviously have X, we know the names of the individuals that are on in OHA or in the DHS system, and my question is, and you don't know the answer, I don't think, to this, I guess is does OHA and DHS, are they able to identify who's a veteran, in which then an evaluation can be made? Obviously, this takes revenue. I got that picture, right? Then an evaluation made that we should be focusing or going in and trying to address these specific cases we already have that may be able to also get veterans benefits to offset our costs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll have to get back on the definitive answer in terms of do they flag veteran status. We have a bill currently in the works in terms of having a no-wrong-door referral system. So I think we're at the beginning stages of that, but certainly not as far as we should be.
Right, I'm just looking 2, 4, 6 years down the road again, trying to forecast. I know Dave Dodder told me Marines don't do forecasting beyond things, but we're going to get 6 years out. Where are we going to be 6 years from now, and how do we do that, and what's the... what are some mechanisms, maybe not even this year, but 2 years from now, where we can say, hey, we need to review all of the caseloads that we have at these other agencies to identify veterans and have their files screened to determine if there is a potential of federal benefits that can be put into there that either offset or enhance the services we're able to provide. I mean, pure dollars and cents, trying to help the veteran, and once again asking the veteran to help somebody else by getting on the veteran's benefits if it's equal or greater and freeing up those funds for other needy Oregonians. Any thoughts, Madam Vice Chair? Well, with that, we appreciate you bringing this back forward. I would ask council that we'll prepare to move the bills forward and schedule for work session next week, and ask you to circle back around with LFO so that we ensure they have seen these slides, and it is a continued interest in the committee. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 2044 and 2046. And unless somebody else has something they'd like to talk about, anything, colleagues, next week, I think we have 2 weeks worth of public hearings that will be work sessions next week. So we'll be moving through work sessions very quickly. We'll send a reminder out to you if there's any bills you heard this week or last week that you have concerns with, please get a hold of me. But then again, as amendments come up, we'll send them out to the committee members.
So you guys going to have a joint meeting?
Yep. 30th, 2 weeks out. We are towards the end of the month going to have a joint meeting back on the Oregon Resilience Plan issues and emergency preparedness toward the
end. June, definitely.
Yeah, and then in June we're going to have several joint meetings to try and do convenience at times. With that, the meeting for today is closed.